of them Washington. And I heard you. I heard what people were saying. They said, we want more Snap Judgment Live. We want you to do that live show thing again. Well, guess what?
Welcome to Snap Judgment.
Back by popular demand. They said we couldn't do it. We did it. Real people, real stories, rocking it in front of a live audience. Get ready.
Big Jim was good. I had myself a celebration. Lord of mercy.
Snap Judgment Live returns coming soon to this very station from PRX and NPR. Storytelling with an audience. Get ready. Come on in. Get real close, because you're listening to Snap Judgment, the podcast. Get ready. Welcome to Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR. And this time, folks, we're doing it live. This is at the beautiful downtown Mission District Brava Theater. We're calling this one Wild Kingdom. Strap on tight and get ready. I was going to Taiwan with my good friend Amy for a birthday. It's cool. She was going back for a homecoming of sorts. She hadn't been there for years, meeting all her relatives. And she knew me for a while, so she said, don't say anything stupid. Come on now, come on. I'm saying nothing stupid. So we were going around, and I didn't have a chance to say anything because people kept putting food into my mouth. It was delicious. It was duck and chicken and beef. It was wonderful, the best food I've ever had in my life, and was all prelude to the big birthday celebration. Amazing. It was one course after another, cracked crab, lobster. It was incredible, and the final course, these guys came out with this huge plate, each with a large fish on it, just came out, bam. And they said, you're the guest of honor. You get to have the first bite. Cool. I went over there. Everybody's looking at me. Don't say nothing stupid, all right? Looking at me, and Houston, there was a problem. This fish was breathing. Wanna eat. The fish is breathing, and they say fish don't blink. Fish don't blink. They lie. Fish blink. And this fish was blinking at me. So, all blinking at me. And then he started talking to me. He said, Glenn, eat me. Welcome to Snap Judgment. We'll be right back. The fish said, eat me. All right, then. Eat the fish. Go ahead, take a little bitty bite. A little taste. The fish. It's kind of good. But with a tricksy fish. You tricked me. Because it was poison. Didn't poison my body, but poison my soul, my mind. What is going on? And from that day forward, that fish made me a vegetarian. Today on Snap Judgment. Our four-limbed friends, the ones that swim, crawl, jump, hop, you know, those animal friends, we're calling this one Animal Tales, all of the stories, how we commune with Mother Nature. But this here, all of this right here is storytelling with a beat. And you don't get a beat, friends, unless you got a band. They introduce Mr. Alex Mandel and the Snap Judgment Players. DJ D'Android and the ones and twos. What? Right over there. I am so thrilled to introduce you to our first storyteller of the night. This lady is unbelievable. She, as a very wee little girl, 4 years old, got a big family in St. Thomas, and they used to gather from miles around and come hear her tell stories to her extended family. And since we at Snap Judgment, we're all extended family. Right? We're going to bring her out here tonight. Would you please give a warm, extremely warm welcome to Tabitha Christopher.
Growing up in the Caribbean left in a residue of me of some unbelievable pastimes as I learned how things are done in my culture of West Indian people. My mother and father growing up owned a chicken and goat farm. And out of all the animals, my most favorite one was Big Jim, the ram goat. One Saturday morning, my grandfather came to town. Now, one thing I learned very early on is that whenever my grandfather show up, somebody going to die. So he wasn't one of my most favorite people to see. My mother tell me this one morning, Tabby, go down the hill and say good morning to your grandfather. Why? You know I don't like he. Why I go down the hill and say good morning to he for? Tabby, go down the hill, say good morning to help the relationship along. So I went bounding down the hill with a skip in my step to make myself feel better about seeing my grandfather. Grandpa! Grandpa! All of a sudden, I hear this loud bleating coming from down the hill. And I recognize that voice. So I went running down the hill. Grandpa! Grandpa! I ain't seen nothing. All of a sudden, I see this wide-brim hat come merging out the bush. Hear my grandfather pulling Big Jim by the hands hard. Come, 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 up yourself, bring yourself up, up. And my father coming from behind, pushing Big Jim butt from out the bush, pushing him. I stand back and look. I say, what these man here doing to my goat? Then I think to myself, oh, they're checking my goat for ticks and fleas to make sure nothing is sucking the life out of he. So I appreciate that. But my grandfather keep pulling my goat over to the big rock. So I stand still. I see my grandfather lay my goat head on the rock. I watching. Then the man come out and pull out this long machete out of nowhere. Raise it up. Grandpa, no! Sha! And my goat's head went rolling down the hill. Grandpa, you a murderer. You kill my goat. You kill my goat. My grandfather look up. My father look up. They didn't know I was standing there watching the whole thing. And then my grandfather looked to my father. Darren, tell the child. Tell the child the truth. My father looked at me with sad eyes. Tabby, Daryl, shut your mouth, shut. Tabby, come here, come here. Why you think your mother will be cooking every night? Yeah, yeah. Why you think your mother and father got all these chicken and goat wrong here for? You think that chicken come from the grocery store? Heh, no, that's your goat, that's your chicken. Grow up, that's life. I stood there looking at my grandfather, and then I turned around the hill, running up the hill, crying. My sister heard me crying from way down the hill. She come outside. Tabby, what grandpa do you? Tima, grandpa killed Big Jim. What? Yeah, man. We gotta have a funeral. And we gotta make a pact never to eat Big Jim. Okay. So we went to my bedroom and we sat down on the floor to pray. And remember all the times Big Jim tried to kill us. Next thing you know, this smell came in from the kitchen. And my sister couldn't keep her head bowed in prayer. She raised it up to sniff. Tabby, you smell that? I raised my head up. Yeah, man. That must be Big Jim. Big Jim smell good. Tima, we don't make a pack. We won't eat none of Big Jim. Yeah, man. You want to go to the kitchen and see what mommy doing? I already know what she doing. She cooking Big Jim. Well, you want to see if mommy need any help? So we went out to the kitchen, and there's my mother sitting there in front of the oven, stirring this big old pot. Mommy, what's that in that pot? And she turned, look at me. Tabby, well, nope, I don't want to hear it. I know where it is. That's Big Jim. Tima, let's go pray. So I went back to my room thinking my sister was right behind me. But I hear she said to my mother, Mommy, you need any help? And that was all I hear. So I was inside in my bedroom floor praying for 30 minutes, and my sister never came back. So I decided to get up and see where she is. So I come out the bedroom, and I hear this loud noise. So I creep up slow, and then I peep around the corner. My sister sitting right there at the table with her face in the soup, eating Big Jim. Tima! You eating a lot of Big Jim? Huh? Me no around with you. I won't go starve all night. Big Jim was good. You want some? No, man. Me want none of that. Shh. How it taste? It good, you know. Try some, no? No, man, me want none of that. Big Jim was good. I had myself a celebration. Lord of mercy.
Don't go anywhere. Snap Judgment Live continues in just 60 seconds. Stay tuned. You're listening to Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR. Today, we're at San Francisco's Brava Theater. Snap Judgment, Wild Kingdom.
Okay, I need all you haters to get your knives out. Because the next storyteller tonight, he's got these rugged good looks, piercing blue eyes, athletic, good looking, he can swim in molten lava. He wrestles sharks. Philanthropy through the Summit series. An amazing brother. Kind you read about in magazines. In fact, he writes for one called Outside. He's all that. Hate him. No. Love him. Love him tonight on Snap Judgment. A warm welcome for Mr. Thayer Walker.
A while back, I got word about this place in Bolivia where the laws of nature do not apply. Somewhere down there in the jungle, there was an animal refuge where volunteers were taking care of jaguars. Taking care of jaguars. Now, I'm not talking about cleaning pens or throwing meat through the bars of a cage. No. This was a seriously interactive zoological experience. As it goes, if you volunteered for a month of your time, you'd be assigned to a large predatory cat to walk on a leash through the jungle for 8 hours a day. What could go wrong? There was no experience necessary. All you needed was a plane ticket, some free time, and a whole lot of questionable judgment.
So there I was in Bolivia. It's the wet season, and the mosquitoes were swarming in clouds. The downpour was biblical. And the first person I met was an Israeli. His name was Adir. He was 23 years old. He had just spent the last 4 years in the Israeli army as an explosives expert. So apparently, walking jaguars was his idea of a nice way to relax. Anyhow, he'd been there for about a month, so he was a real expert. And he showed me the ropes. Rule number one, don't touch the jaguar. Rule number two, if the jaguar touches you, don't move. You're only going to excite him more. Rule number three, if the jaguar bites you, stick your arm in his mouth. Wait a second. Hold on. Stick my what in his where? Yes, because if your arm is in his mouth, it means that your head isn't. Then there was rule number four. Never let him smell your fear. And off we went. As we approached the enclosure, I got a glimpse of this cat for the first time. His name was Rupi. He was 7 years old. He'd been at the refuge nearly his entire life. He was an alpha male, 260 pounds. Even from a distance, he was massive. His head was wide and heavy like a cinder block. His arms thick like a telephone pole. His coat, yellow and black, he looked like a walking shadow and was 100% rippling feline muscle. Adir was undaunted. He opened up the cage, grabbed the leash, clipped it to the collar, and brought the cat out. Then he very promptly broke rule number one. He leaned down and pet the cat on the head. Rupi seemed to like it because he licked the deer in the face. Now, a lot of these animals had come from abusive situations. Some of the cats even had been forced to jump through rings of fire at the local circus. So seeing this interspecies love fest between Adir and Rupi put me at ease. And it made me envious. So we began our walk. Adir had the leash, and for the first hour, Rupi ignored me. Then Adir looked at me and said, "Your turn." Oh, well, you know, I was just going to watch today. I mean, it's my first day. You're doing a great job. You know, maybe tomorrow. Come on, man. This is Bolivia. You came down here to walk a jaguar. So walk a jaguar. I hadn't been peer pressured since high school. I took the leash. Now, Rupi was a very smart animal. You see, he could smell fresh meat. Because as soon as I took that leash, bang! He goes tearing off into the jungle, dragging me behind him. Suddenly, I'm water skiing behind a runaway jaguar. I let some slack out of the leash so as not to choke him, a freedom he promptly takes to leap onto a tree. He springboards off the trunk and comes back at me with naked tooth and claw, slams me to the ground. Then, my world turned a slobbery black, and Rupi opened those giant, skull-crushing jaguar jaws and wrapped them around my face. His canines buried into my temples and my cheekbones, and hot jaguar breath seeped through my eyelids. His tonsils blacked out the sun. And then, when the world finally came back into focus, I found myself spread eagle on the ground with a jaguar standing on my chest. Don't move. Don't move. And I didn't. for a very, very long time. Felt like an eternity. And then I thought, geez, this must be over by now. So on my back, I tried to roll out from under the cat, and wham! Nah, this game was not over. I look at a deer. Hey, buddy, little help? A deer runs over and does the rodeo clown thing, distracting the cat. Finally, Rupee lets me up, saunters off into the jungle. For him, this was just a game, nothing but a show of dominance. I check my vitals. No injuries, at least physically. And then I turn to a deer. Hey, man, so is this a typical jaguar welcome? You know, I'd never seen that before. That was really special. We continued on our walk, but this was no jungle I had ever seen. I flew down to Bolivia to walk a jaguar. As it turns out, it was the jaguar that was walking me.
Hey! Badoop! Tape change time again. Give it up for the band and all the other storytellers. All of them, huh? Yep. Oh, man. You know, it was funny getting over here tonight. I was listening to the radio, and they were playing this song I really love. They were playing Rapper's Delight. You guys know that song? Classic. Classic song. You guys don't remember it. It's the first really popular rap song. It's the one that goes like, hip hop, a hippie to the hip hip, etc. That song, classic, yep. I don't know if you know this though, but that song is 15 minutes long. I know, right? That is too long. There are no rap songs that long anymore. Somebody loves it. There are no rap songs that long anymore, and when you listen to Rapper's Delight, you realize it's because at some point, you just run out of stuff to rap about. Because for the first 10 minutes of Rapper's Delight, it's like every other rap song, right? I'm awesome. I get lots of ladies. Here's how you do a dance. I know how you do. Pretty much every rap song in about 3 lines. And it's like that for the first 10 minutes, but then it gets to like minute 10, and he starts talking about like having dinner at a friend's house and stuff like that. Like scraping the bottom of the barrel. In terms of rap topics, like this is Rapper's Delight word for word at minute 10. It's a, have you ever been over to a friend's house to eat and the food just ain't no good? I said the macaroni soggy, the peas are mushed, and the chicken tastes like wood. It's like, dude, just stop rapping. Like, you don't have to keep rapping. All right, everybody, the tapes are changed. Goodbye.
In just a few moments, Snap Judgment, live. Be right back. Welcome back to Snap Judgment from NPR and PRX. We return you now to the Snap Judgment live show, already in progress.
Renaissance man, this Renaissance man, that Renaissance man. How's about a Renaissance woman? That's right. teacher, director, cinematographer, flight instructor. No, she doesn't fly anything. An amazing woman. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is her storytelling debut. That's right. A warm welcome from Ms. Kate Ascott Evans.
Life in South Africa was rarely quiet. My parents were always fighting. I was 13 and all I wanted was a family that worked. And then I got an unusual chance to make that happen. It started when Abigail, my brand new pet mouse, suddenly gave birth to 7 beautiful pink babies. She built them a cotton wool nest and was such a happy mother, I decided to keep them. My mother agreed on one condition. The boys and the girls can't be together, huh, Kate? Because if there's one thing that breeds faster than rabbits, it's mice. Picking each mouse up by its tail and checking for tiny testicles, she determined there was only one male, Norman. But separating Norman seemed awful, so my mom suggested we just simply have him neutered. I agreed. The tiniest testicular surgery of all time was a success, and Abigail's family stayed intact. My family, however, would not. Very shortly afterwards, my parents announced that they were getting divorced. And it was a hard moment. I felt both heartbroken and relieved. I locked myself in my bedroom and I went to go sit by my mice. And there by the food bowl, lying on his back with this huge blood clot over where his balls would have been, was Norman. He was dead. And it was my fault. My mother wasn't so sure. No, Kate, this had nothing to do with the surgery. No, nothing at all. Turned out that Norman wasn't the only male in the litter. His sisters, vice versa, and Dapple were also boys. But I had let Abigail down and killed her son. I was not going to split this family up any further. I told myself that I had raised them with good mouse morals, and the boys would just definitely not try sleep with their sisters. And then I had 40 mice. Now, I wasn't the only member of my human family to retreat into my own world. My mother took up astrology reading, and daily she had new proof that my dad really was the wrong man for her. You see, Kate, your father, he is a Taurus with a Sagittarius rising. And that, Kate, that means he doesn't listen. My father had taken a more Don Juan approach to coping. When I called his new home, I was greeted by messages like, "Hello, you've reached the love doctor. Here for all your love needs." Beep. "Hi, Pop, it's Kate. Just wanted to call and say hello." Perhaps in retaliation, my mom suggested that I relocate my mice to my dad's now empty home office, since he won't be needing it anymore. My dad moved out and Abigail's family moved in. My social life consisted of washing out cages and cutting up vegetables, all to keep this family happy. I had 80 mice. And then one day, I reached into the cage to check on the latest litter. The newborns were nowhere to be seen. And that's when I found it. A single bloody baby mouse head. I was freaked out. My mom reassured me, it's natural. Because sometimes in nature, when animals get stressed, they just eat their young. But I knew I'd failed at being a good parent. By the time the tumors started appearing, I was in over my head. My father lovingly explained, "Well, what do you expect, Kate? You diluted the gene pool." The tumors were huge. They grew as rapidly as the mice bred. I was forced to quarantine the sick on the other side of my dad's office. Remembering the red disinfectant my mom used on my scrapes when I was little, nightly I'd dab cotton balls of mercurochrome onto their wounds and tumors. It didn't help. I had an infirmary of blood-red mutant mice. I had just turned 14. I had over 100 mice and a lot of death. Burying my dead pets was too much. I just wasn't ready to say goodbye. Instead, I took their tiny corpses, wrapped them in tissue, put them in a Ziploc bag marked mice, and put that in the freezer next to the strawberry ice cream. 14 with a mice morgue. The stress took its toll. I had nightmares, insomnia. I wandered the house like a strung-out zombie. Until finally there came a point where my mom looked up from her tarot cards and for the first time in a while, she really saw me. "No, no, no more kites, uh-uh. They're going to the pet store." I kept 3 mice, including Abigail. I said goodbye to 132 others. And once again, I felt both heartbroken and relieved. When we got home, the house was eerily quiet. No shouting parents, no squeaking mice. My mom helped me pack up all of the now empty cages, and looking at all the chaos, I thought of Norman, how my need to keep the family together had led to all of this. On my dad's desk, one cage remained, and inside it, Abigail was building a nest for her new, smaller family. Thank you.
Our next guest generally works as another type of storyteller. He is a stop-motion animator. Put your hands together for Mr. Scott Kravitz.
Hi, I stole something from a homeless person. One day I walked outside of my apartment and there was a dog just sitting there in my driveway. I could tell the dog was sick, but there was nobody around and the dog didn't have a collar, so I just put her in my car and dropped her off at the animal shelter. And A week later, they called me to say that nobody had claimed the dog, and she was too sick to put up for adoption, so they were going to euthanize her that afternoon. Now, I didn't want that on my conscience, but I knew that I couldn't take her because my apartment didn't allow dogs, and even if it did, I just didn't want that responsibility. But nevertheless, at 5 o'clock, I was back at the animal shelter picking up the dog. And my plan at the time was to sneak her into my apartment, nurse her back to health, and then find her a home as quickly as possible. And I really didn't want to get attached to this dog, so I purposely didn't name her. But then one day we were walking, and this homeless guy started yelling, "Anne, Anne!" And that's when I discovered that not only was her name Anne, but she had been raised on the streets and knew all the homeless people. And suddenly I was cool with all the panhandlers. And it was like Hate Street had become this giant, filthy nightclub. And I was dating this girl who knew everyone that worked there. But the turning point came when I met the ex. She was a 16-year-old runaway named Sheila. And she came up and hugged Anne and thanked me for taking care of her and started to take her back. And when I asked her where she had been, she said, you know, the Presidio, like, that's the place where homeless people like to summer. And when I asked her why she hadn't been looking for Anne, why she hadn't gone to the shelter, she said she just figured someone else was watching the dog. And that's when I kind of snapped. I don't know if you've ever had this experience when all your politics get in a cage fight with your better judgment. I mean, Sheila was clearly the dog's owner, and it wasn't for me to tell her how to live. But legally, the dog belonged to me. I had adopted her just minutes before a death that Sheila did nothing to prevent. Plus, I knew if I gave Anne back, then her life expectancy was pretty short. So I finally told Sheila that she could have Anne back if she could get herself in a stable situation where she could keep a dog. I even offered to let her use my apartment, my bathroom, my phone, my computer, anything except live there, if it would help her find a place. Sheila made a counterproposal, which was essentially that we have a duel. She and I would stand about 20 feet apart with Anne in the middle, and then we would each call to the dog, and whomever Anne ran to would be her owner. But I felt that the possible gain in legitimacy wasn't worth the risk of losing the dog, and I turned her down. Plus, I didn't know what sort of secret street treat she might have to entice the dog. I mean, Anne was still very much part of that world. Sometimes I'd even, you know, when nobody was looking, I'd even lay down on the sidewalk myself just to see how happy it made her. So over the next month, I found I was really falling for this dog. I mean, she was smart and affectionate, and having grown up on the street, she wasn't freaked out by strange people or commotion. She was the perfect dog. And ironically, the more attached I grew to Anne, the more empathy I had for Sheila. But then one day, my brother called to say he had finally found a woman in L.A. who would take the dog. So that weekend, I drove Anne down to L.A. and dropped her off at this woman's house. But the moment I got back in my car, I just started crying. I kept thinking about a friend of mine who had gotten married really young. She said that she wishes she had met her husband later in life so that she could have experienced more life as a single adult. But she knew that if she waited until she was ready to get married, somebody as perfect as her husband wouldn't have been around. I knew that I wasn't ready for a dog, but I felt that when I was ready for a dog, I wanted it to be Anne. And then I suddenly turned the car around and raced back to this woman's house to beg for Anne back. And a few minutes later, I was standing on her doorstep getting a lecture about how unfair I was being because the woman's cat had just accepted Anne. And the cat would be very upset if Anne left. But eventually I wore her down and got Anne back. So now I had basically stolen the dog from two women and a cat. And on top of that, I had to find a new place to live. So I bought a house. And as I was packing up my things to move out of my apartment, I got a phone call from Sheila. She said that she and some friends were going to travel around the country in a camper so she could finally have Ann back. And I said no. And that was it. Now I was the homeowner denying the homeless. I felt like I had become the man to whom I'd always wanted to stick it. You know, there are some stories that we tell so often they become a routine. This isn't one of those. Instead, I gradually worked up a story that was very sweet and heroic and absolutely true, despite the fact that it made no mention of Sheila. And I told that story so many times that I'd almost allowed myself to forget about this part of it. I mean, it happened 11 years ago, and I got a house and a great dog as a result. And I haven't seen Sheila around in years, which is good because I hope that she's doing well. I hope that she's healthy and living in safety and comfort, but I'm still keeping the dog. Thanks.
My wife had just given me a brand new baby boy. I cut the umbilical cord, washed him in a little basin. I toweled him off and I wrapped him up in a blanket and I gave him to her. And I've just never felt so much love. Love for her, love for him, so happy for our family. And she said, Glenn, I need to ask you something. I was like, baby, anything, anything. I need you to get cut. What? What? We gotta get a little second opinion on that one, baby. Gotta talk to the doctor, man. So, you know, all right, do that. So I went and talked to the doctor. I was like, doctor, I have mountains left to climb. I got oceans to swim through. I don't want any trouble happening. He's like, don't worry about it. Everything's cool. Don't worry about it. Is it going to hurt? Yeah, it's going to hurt. You know, I figured I'm athletic, whatever. You know, I kept it. Do my thing. It's not going to hurt too bad, you know? So I had it done. The problem was the doctor was right. Kind of took a little bit of a step out of my giddy up. He said, get you some cold peas, some frozen peas. Man, what you talking about? The problem was that I had a meeting right after the surgery. Yeah, I didn't want to, but the funders of this program, you know who you ams, said I had to meet. So I was like, all right. And the good news was my wife had given me these new earphones and this new phone and stuff. I was all nerded up. I was Geordi and Data. I was going about my business. All right, let's do it. Let's go on, get this done. And then, I saw them. It was three of them. Jackals. Strong, sleek, middle of downtown San Francisco. And they was looking at my stuff. They was gonna come take my stuff. And I was trying to get away, but I couldn't do it. And they saw the gazelle had a weak leg. It's gonna get on. Couldn't move too fast, right? Couldn't move too fast. And they were circling. They were circling me. Three of them coming on strong. And I didn't have any other choice. I ducked back into an alcove. I ducked back. I took out my new phone. Wasn't nobody there. They didn't know that. Who you think this is? I'm gonna stick this phone up your mama's behind first and then yours. And you saw the jackals kind of, what? What's going on? That's right. No, I'm coming to your house. And then I looked at him. I gave my Detroit glaze there. Who you looking at? You get some too. Stick this phone up both y'all's behind. And they kind of kept on moving. They wasn't too for sure. Kept on moving. Go on. Go on. Safe. Ha ha! That's right. Get going to my meeting, baby. You know what? Happy as I could be. I had stared at the jackals, had a new baby boy. Everything was all right. And really, that's the end of my story. I thought that was the end of my story. Till just a week ago, I was with that little baby who's now a bigger boy playing frisbee. Friend's backyard, having some hot dogs, potato chips, getting that love for the family. I'm just like so happy, so happy. Hold my wife's hand, and she said, "You know, Glenn, you know what we need? Nah, darling, what we need? We need a new baby." We gotta get a new dog, play some Monopoly, something like that. This right here, this has been a Snap Judgment. Snap Judgment production. And that right there is Mr. Alex Mandel. Animal tales, animal stories. David Brandt on the sticks. Tim Frick on the bass. DJ the Android. Snap Judgment. And NPR production. Peace and soul.
So many thank yous are in order. So many, many, many thanks to Jeanette Aguilar, the producer who made all things smooth sailing, and our entire production army, the production crew, the sound, the stage crew. Y'all rock. You rock it. PRX. And don't forget, thank you to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Team Snap, Will Urbina, Anna Sussman, Rita Daniels, Stephanie Fu, and today, Jeremy Black, you're one of us. Thank you. The Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. I am Glenn Washington, peace and soul from the Snap, because even though this is not the news, no way is this the news, this is NPR. The producer of this very podcast, listening, judging, and condemning all she hears out of my mouth right now, is Snap Judgment's own podcast producer, Rita Daniels.